Hi, and welcome to Mormon Expression. I am Clay Painter, and today I'll be interviewing a special guest, Lindsay Whitehurst, who is a journalist for the Salt Lake Tribune, and we'll be talking about Utah polygamy and polygamy issues in general. As a way of introduction, Lindsay grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. She got her degree in journalism and American studies from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She has been a journalist for about 7 years and has worked for newspapers in Indiana, New Mexico, and for the Salt Lake Tribune, and has won journalistic awards in all of those areas. Lindsay Whitehurst, welcome to Mormon Expression.
Hi, how are you?
So, Lindsay, among other responsibilities at the Salt Lake Tribune, it is your job to keep your fingers on the pulse of all things polygamist. Am I correct?
You could say that, yeah.
Good. Well, thanks for coming on. And I guess to start, if you could maybe give us a little bit of an overview of your journalistic background and maybe how you ended up reporting on polygamy at the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm assuming, I could be wrong, but I'm assuming while you were studying at Miami University, you didn't think 10 years you'd be, doing polygamy stories in Salt Lake.
I did not think that, and I did have a double major with American Studies, but somehow we never touched on polygamy, even in those classes.
Yeah, nice.
But it was. So I went to school in Ohio, got my first job in Indiana, kind of a fading auto town. It was really big in the auto industry back in the day, and those jobs are all just kind of gone now, as you can imagine. So I worked there for a few years. I covered city government, and kind of general stuff, and then thought I'd like to try a new part of the country and found myself in New Mexico. And that's where I covered the Navajo Nation, the Navajo Reservation out there, actually, which is a very interesting experience coming from the Midwest and moving out west. And then I got the job in Salt Lake City, and I covered just kind of cops and crime and breaking news, a lot of different stuff for a few years before the previous polygamy reporter actually basically left that beat after she authored a memoir with a polygamous family. And so she's covering some different topics now, and I took over this beat about a year ago. And it was funny when they sort of offered it to me, they were kind of like, well, I think we'll be covering polygamy from sort of 10,000 feet. It won't be as crazy and on the ground as it was, say, during the 2008 raid in Texas, which we covered.
Sure, yeah.
But then it turned out this year has been a really crazy year in polygamy news. Between the Warren Jeffs trial and the turmoil within that sect, and then Cody Brown, the reality show star of Sister Wives, filing a lawsuit to try and get polygamy decriminalized. There's been a lot of polygamy news this year, so I'm very, very active as it's turned out, but it's been really interesting and exciting to be covering it.
Yeah, cool. And yeah, it's definitely been a hot topic in the media. Before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty, I'm sure some of the listeners would be interested in that memoir that the previous journalist helped mm-hmm. author. What is that, and who was that was working on that?
It's called Love Times Three, and it was written by the Darger family, which is Joe Darger and his three wives, Vicki, Elena, and I'm going to space his third wife's name. But anyway, Joe Darger and his three wives wrote that with Brooke Adams, who was the polygamy reporter before. Okay. And it's their story. It's kind of a big love type family, you could say, kind of a suburban, very kind of well-dressed, good-looking family that writes about, you know, their polygamous marriage, and they really, you know, believe in it strongly, obviously, and feel very strongly that it's a really great thing for them and their family, and they of course want it to be decriminalized as well. So they've done a lot of been in the national media a lot since that book came out, and in our local media here in Salt Lake City. So yeah, it's an interesting take.
Yeah,
interesting story.
So maybe you could give us kind of a broad overview of what the polygamous landscape in Utah and in North America looks like right now. What are some of the major sects out there, and maybe some of the major differences between those groups?
So there's about four, give or take, major sects here in Utah. The total population of everybody living in polygamous communities here in Utah is estimated at about 38,000, give or take. That's a little bit of an old number, but it's kind of a good starting point to give you an idea of how many people we're talking about. And those are people living in polygamous communities. So not every one of those people is in a polygamous relationship. Mm-hmm. That's something that's kind of important to know. There are plenty of folks that live within the FLDS or within, you know, some of these other groups that have monogamous relationships. But some of the major ones are the FLDS, of course, Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they're about 10,000 members, probably a little bit more than that now. Okay. And they're one of the ones, obviously, that has the highest profile. And they women that are part of that group wear the prairie dresses, so they're very kind of visually distinctive that way. They have the wave hair. The leader is Warren Jeffs, who went to trial this summer in Texas for marrying two underage girls, and he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. At that trial, I think there was a lot of kind of ugly stuff that came out. So that was kind of a shocking thing. But that group has in general, there have been some breakaways, but the majority of people in that group have more or less stayed loyal to Warren Jeffs. And he's really, in the last year he's been in prison, he's really had a lot more strict rules for people for governing their behavior, and a lot of men have been excommunicated. So it's been a tumultuous year within that group, and that's one reason it's been grabbing a lot of headlines even lately. So that's one major one. Another one is AUB, which in some ways could not be more different. That's the one that Cody Brown and his wives, his four wives, belong to, and they're the Stars of Sister Wives on TLC. Okay.
And just to clarify, is that the Apostolic United Brethren? Is that what
Apostolic?
The
AUB? Apostolic United Brethren. Yeah, okay. And that was so that was led by Rulon Allred for a long time, and there's a lot of backstory there too. But the members of that group are much more modern. You wouldn't necessarily be able to pick them out of anybody walking on the street. They probably do still dress more modestly than is sort of completely mainstream. But sure. But you look at Cody Brown and that family, you know, they look like regular suburban folks, you know. So that's generally that group. And they have a few different places where they live here in Utah, but then their members are also kind of spread out. The Brown family, for example, lived in Lehi before they moved to Nevada just last year, the year before. And so that's another good-sized group and a major group. So they're a big one, and then there are some others that are sort of the biggest portion of that 38,000 people is actually independent. The Darger family that we were talking about before, they actually they consider themselves independent, not part of any one of these groups. So another big one is the Kingstons. They get some media attention from time to time. The other name for that group that's probably preferable to them is the Davis County Co-op.
Okay.
And so they're another major one, and especially maybe about 8-10 years ago, they got some press that was some negative press, but that group hasn't been quite as much attention, quite as much kind of in the media in the last few years. So
yeah, sure. And before we kind of dive into the details of things in the news that have been going on, and maybe the Warren Jeffs trial and things like that, when you talk about the independents being the biggest part, what are their dynamics? I mean, do they meet together? Do they meet in church services? Do they meet in regular? I've heard that some of these people still have loose ties to the mainstream LDS church. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
You know, and I have heard about, and I don't know any of these. I don't know anybody who still didn't know directly of anyone who is polygamous and still attends regular LDS church. But I've heard from some of the Principal Voices folks. This is a group, a pro polygamy group. That there are, you know, here and there a few that either whether they still practice actively polygamy or have sort of come through study to feel like to believe in it, if not necessarily practice it, that those folks are scattered around sometimes in mainstream churches. But you know, I think that, so for them, they still know each other a lot. It's still not a huge community, so I think they still talk to each other and meet together. I don't, generally independent, I believe, and I'm not as familiar, and everybody's different, of course, that's why they're independent, you know.
Sure.
So every family's a little bit different, but I think a lot of them do church at home. But I'm not 100% on that. I'm not as familiar with exactly what all the independents do, and it also probably varies. So yeah. they just don't belong to any of those groups and don't live in any of the major communities here in Utah, you know, sure. don't physically live with them for the most part. And you know, there's a lot of divisions, within the polygamous communities, small and large in terms of interpretations, ecclesiastical ideas and things like that. So it's possible that, you know, people who are independent either have some different interpretations or just kind of don't want to get involved with the kind of ins and outs of all the different beliefs, you know, yeah. in a very slight way sometimes, but obviously are very important to the folks who are living in those groups and have those feelings.
Yeah, and I guess one of the questions that I have is that, at least in the form of kind of polygamous groups and run-in with law enforcement and prosecutions and things like that, my impression is that the FLDS is normally the headline, you know, and mm-hmm. is that accurate? And if so, you know, how did all these other groups stay out of the media? Is it because they're not, you know, doing the same things, or what do you have to say about that?
You know, especially lately, I think it's because the FLDS have been so, there's been a lot of government action, I think, is part of it. You know, that raid in 2008 was so huge, you know, biggest child welfare raid in Texas history, mm-hmm. you know, so whatever group that was, polygamous or not polygamous, that would have gotten a lot of media attention, you know,
sure.
and then the polygamy angle, and I think partly it's that just the visual angle of these folks that look so different from our mainstream society, I think all of that, you know, all of these things just came together to really just amp that story up hugely, you know? And so I think that that's part of it. And I think also just, you know, Warren Jeffs, he's, I think he's the type of figure that tends to attract attention, you know?
Yeah.
The extremeness and the strangeness and the criminal nature of what, the way he's kind of run things since he took over leadership of that group in 2002, almost ever since then. I think prior to Warren Jeffs, I don't think the FLDS got quite as much attention. They were still, you know, out there, and they still occasionally got some media coverage. But it was really when Warren Jeffs took over and really started doing some of the you know, sensational things that he's done, from starting with the excommunication of like 20 men in 2004, which was a huge deal at the time, and now to me doesn't even seem like a large number compared to what he's done lately. And when that happened, a lot of those guys sort of came out and they made public statements against him, you know, and so that started getting a lot of attention then, and that's probably more or less the starting point. And then, you know, from there, it's just been one thing after another, you know. Shortly around that same time, there was the Lost Boys that were filing lawsuits saying these are young men, and, you know, according to them, they were kicked out to reduce competition for wives. There's some, you know, the FLDS and their attorneys have said, no, that's really not quite it. These that's not the whole story with these boys, but, you know, so they sued, and Jeff started basically avoiding those lawsuits. And then there was a takeover of the Sex Property Trust, another one of those early Mormon beliefs, holding property communally. So they had held this everywhere, all their houses and their businesses and everything was all held communally. And, yeah. And so they had sued, when the Lost Boys sued, they sued that trust.
Yeah.
And Warren Jeffs and the other trustees, that they just avoided these lawsuits. They just didn't respond to them whatsoever. And this guy, Rod Parker, who had been a longtime FLDS attorney, he said, look, if these guys win these lawsuits by default, this trust doesn't have any liquid assets. It's all in houses and land, and there would have to be property that would be sold, and people could be losing their houses here. And the state's solution to that was, well, we'll take it over. They're not managing it well. They're not paying attention to these lawsuits. People could lose their houses, so they basically no longer deserve to be the trustees of this trust, and we're going to take it over. And that remains that contest over that trust remains going today. That was back in 2005, and now 7 years later, it's still very much in court. The trust is $5 million in debt. It's kind of a quagmire at this point.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, it seems that that trust prior to Warren Jeffs was more of a communal trust, but am I wrong that Warren Jeffs got his father to sign over kind of sole charge of that trust to himself, to Warren Jeffs? And so is that wrong or
I don't think that's correct. There's a lot of backstory and a lot of history, and I don't know all of the details of it, but as I understand it, there were still trustees at the point when it was taken over. There was still, you know, there was still a group of trustees, a committee of trustees. At least the two I know about for sure that I've done the most research on is Jeff's and a guy by the name of William E. Jessup, who who at the time was the Bishop of Short Creek. So kind of Warren's number two, you know, number two or number three, depending on how you look at it, but a very high ranking elder in the church. And he's got a very interesting backstory, and he's since kind of reemerged against Jeffs as a rival prophet. And there's a whole very interesting, intricate story there. But I know from doing research that at least he was also a trustee that at the time they were doing all this, they wanted to serve him. Okay. And I know there were others at that point. So,
but right now the state is, in charge of it, I guess, or has taken that over, and that's in the middle of a lawsuit. Is that right?
Right. The state took it over in 2005, and at first, the FLDS really didn't do anything about it. They didn't really cooperate. They sort of occasionally paid. Because before, everybody could just live there and for free, basically. You built your house, you know, your own house, so it's not free, but everybody kind of helped each other, and there wasn't like any mortgages or anything like that. And the guy who was appointed to run the trust, Bruce Wiseman, he initially started trying to have people pay $100 a month occupancy fee. And sometimes people pay that, sometimes not, but essentially they didn't really show up and cooperate with Wiseman, but they also didn't do anything to fight it until 3 years later in 2008 after that raid in Texas.
Yeah.
And then they started fighting it in court, and the FLDS, there is a decent amount of money in that group. There are some people who are there that are very wealthy. And also they have, you know, the communal nature of it. They don't really live, you know, very extravagant lives. They don't really have televisions or any of the kind of modern devices that we use. So the point of all this is that they hire very good attorneys. And so it's been a long, ugly court battle, and very complicated. In 2010, the FLDS was sort of dealt a setback, in that the Utah Supreme Court dismissed their case. Their case was that the state of Utah violated the separation of church and state when they took over this trust, because we believe in holding property communally as a religious principle.
Okay.
And also, you know, these are our assets. We're a church. How can the state just come in and take our assets? That was their whole point. And what the Supreme Court did was, instead of really taking on that issue and really hashing it all out legally, they dismissed the case on a sort of obscure legal principle called latches, which means you waited too long. Those 3 years that you let this go, people got involved, money got involved, a lot of people put a lot of work into this, and you just can't waltz in here 3 years later and say, oh no, we want it back. So they didn't get into really all the constitutional questions. They just kind of said, you just waited too long to file your claim, and so your reasons and your case is kind of mooted by that, because you waited too long. And that's actually like an ancient legal principle from England. It's not even law per se. So what they did is actually the FLDS was pursuing this along parallel tracks. They had filed their case in both Utah state courts and the federal courts. And initially when they first filed it in 08, the federal judge, Dee Benson, actually declined to look at it. He said, let's let this work itself out in the state. I'm not going to judge this case right now. Let's see what the state does. Well, then when the state court dismissed it 2 years later, they brought it back to Benson. And Benson at that point decided, yes, I am going to wage into this, and I'm going to look at this, and I'm going to decide that this was a violation of the Constitution. You can't do this. You can't just run in and take over a church's assets, and you've got to give it back.
Uh-huh.
You've got to give it all back. And that just created a legal firestorm, because the state court judge who's been overseeing this whole thing for 7 years, she just kind of said, oh, no, you don't. And she told Wisen not to turn over any of his records, and it was this whole judicial firestorm. Benson threatened to send the federal marshals after her. It was kind of crazy. So then the Utah Attorney General appealed that ruling to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. So that's sort of where we're at now, is that that case is at the Court of Appeals. And what's actually happened now is the Court of Appeals sort of sided with the Attorney General in saying that that Benson possibly shouldn't have been ruling that case in the first place. That we don't know. This is the hard part, is that Attorney General said, Benson, you can't rule in this case because the Supreme Court already dismissed it. That's double jeopardy. You can't do it. It's the same case. And Benson said, well, actually, this latches idea is such an obscure principle. There is no case law in Utah as to whether a latches dismissal is truly a dismissal on the merits of the case. Uh-huh. And so what Benson decided is, he's like, I'm going to look at some other states and what they've done and say, this, it's not actually a dismissal. So he didn't look at what Utah's done, because Utah hasn't done anything with this. He said, well, California and Arizona have treated it this way. So I'm going to decide this was not a dismissal on the merits of the case. They failed to get to the merits of the case. And so I can rule here. Uh-huh. And so when they appealed, the Attorney General made the same argument to the 10th Circuit, saying Benson should have never been ruling on this case. The Utah Supreme Court already ruled. We do believe this was a dismissal on the merits of the case, and so you need to go back to the Supreme Court and ask them what they meant.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the 10th, instead, because Benson decided not to do that. Benson decided not to go back and ask the Utah Supreme Court what they meant by their dismissal. So the 10th Circuit actually sided with the Attorney General. So they bounced it back to the Utah Supreme Court. So now the Utah Supreme Court has got this question in front of them. What did you mean when you dismissed this case? Was this a dismissal on the merits of their constitutional argument or not? Yeah. If not, then possibly Benson's ruling stays and possibly a trust could go back to the FLDS. If so, at least according to the Attorney General, it's possible that could end the case and then the trust stays with the state. We still have this $5 million in debt that's hanging around, too, because with all this litigation is expensive. So, and also, the trust doesn't make any money, you know, and without being able to sell anything, Wisen doesn't have any money to pay for anything. So we've created this enormous amount of debt that the state court Judge Denise Lindbergh, actually decided this public money, the taxpayer money, should pay for that. And so that's kind of the parallel question that's going on here now, is both who should have the trust and how the heck are we going to pay off this huge amount of debt? And the Attorney General has appealed that ruling to the Supreme Court, saying this is a violation of separation of powers. A judicial branch can't order the executive branch to do something. This is not how this works. And so now the Utah Supreme Court has kind of got both of these central questions in front of them, both who should have the trust is what they're deciding boils down to. And then who should pay this money? How are we going to pay off this huge debt?
$5 million,
so it's kind of, yeah, exactly. So it's sort of all in their court right now.
Yeah.
But it's a very emotional thing for the FLDS, because they live in these houses. They work on this land. I mean,
yeah, they've sacrificed a lot to contribute to their own property and their community members' property and stuff. Right. Absolutely.
And this is what we've built, we built this. But the other issue is, even before the state took it over, according to some basically FLDS detractors and critics, the UEP was sort of used, that's the name of the trust, the UEP Trust, United Effort Plan.
Okay.
The UEP was sort of used as a club, like, according to some critics, right? Because so if you disagree, so church leaders in this scenario, church leaders are also your landlords. So if you cross these church leaders, they can kick you out of your house.
Yeah, and out of the community in general.
Out of the community in general, your job is wrapped up with the church as well. Yeah. So if you disagree, or they decide they don't like you anymore, which happens more often, much more often than anybody who's an FLDS member disagreeing. It does happen occasionally, but much more often, especially this year, it's we've decided we don't like you anymore. You're not religious enough. You're not holy enough. Whatever your transgressions are, you're out and you're gone. Yeah. And so they control all of that. So all of a sudden you know, spiritually, your family is listening to those church leaders, and most families do go ahead and leave you if you're judged to be, you know, you need apostate, a correction.
Yeah.
Right? Well, yeah, or just judged to need a correction. Sure. more often than apostate. And then also your house, your job, all that stuff is all really wrapped up in the control of these leaders. Mm-hmm. So that's the other kind of complex thing about the UEP is sort of however the constitutional parts of this are, the practical aspect is you have these, you know, kind of scary church leaders who can control all these material things along with your spiritual future. It's a very interesting, very complex thing.
No, yeah, that's good, and thanks for getting into that. I guess, you know, I want to kind of talk about two things that I know you've written quite a bit about, and I know that they're both extremely detailed and complex issues, but if you could maybe, you know, I know that you were writing about the Warren Jeffs trial quite a bit and that you've covered Browns versus Utah. Maybe if we could walk through an overview of the Warren Jeffs trial, what the charges were, what he got convicted of, how maybe what the key pieces of evidence were that convicted him, and maybe what's developed in kind of the Warren Jeffs story after he's been in jail. And then maybe we can talk about Browns versus Utah a bit, but I don't know where a good starting point is for the Warren Jeffs trial. I don't know if it was the raid down in Texas or what. So I'll let you decide where to start with that.
Well, the starting point with Texas was you could call it the raid. That was one starting point. So Warren, I'll start just a little bit further back, which was Warren was arrested in 2006, and he was arrested, and there was actually charges filed in two states against him. One of them was Utah, and it was Utah that put him on trial first, and they put him on trial for presiding over a marriage of a 14-year-old girl to her 19-year-old cousin. This is Elisa Wall. And he was convicted on those charges, and sent to the Utah State Prison. His conviction, though, was later overturned. And this was not entirely unexpected. This is 2010. The Utah Supreme Court overturned his conviction. The prosecutors in that case filed an accomplice to rape charge against him, okay. Which is a more serious charge than presiding over an illegal ceremony. But it's usually reserved for people who, say, held someone down during the rape, you know, somebody who's more directly involved, whereas Warren was just, you know, kind of acting as the spiritual leader here, you know. So his conviction was overturned in 2010. And in the meantime, while he'd been in prison, in Texas, the FLDS had this, I don't want to call it an outpost because it's what Warren had people buy this property and start this new ranch, the Yearning for Zion Ranch, back in 2004. And this was supposed to be kind of the holiest of holies in a way. The best people were sent there from Short Creek, from Colorado City Hilldale. That was where the most spiritual, best people went into Texas. It's where they built their temple for the first time. This group never had a temple, so it was a really big deal that they had a temple for the first time. And so there was this, you know, kind of shining city on a hill, if you want to call it that, for Warren Jeffs, you know, and his conception of things. And in 08, it gets raided. And it's this enormous raid, Texas authorities. It's really crazy, of course, because it turned out to have been tipped off by a hoax phone call. There never was a 16-year-old girl who was abused there. They took all the children, 400 children, away from that ranch, and they wanted to put them into foster care and keep them away from their parents. But the Texas courts ultimately decided you don't have enough evidence for that, gave the kids back to their parents. But what the Rangers, the Texas Rangers, also did was they took documents. tons and tons of documents. Record keeping is hugely important for the FLDS. It's another way that it's sort of an echo of the mainstream church, but taken to almost more of an extreme. And, you know, this, the belief for them is if our records on earth match those in heaven, then gotta like it, basically. Yeah. And Warren Jeffs took this to even greater extreme. He kept priesthood records, which are essentially diaries of everything he did all day long. I woke up, ate some pancakes. That's the kind of stuff that's in the priesthood record. No joke. Like this extremely detailed story of his day. Uh-huh. And as we found on trial, he also made audio recordings.
Yeah.
So they took these literally just truckloads of documents. We are talking billions of pages of documentation of marriages, of deaths, of, you know, some that's kind of benign about the people's lives. Because when they built this temple, they took all the records they'd been keeping for their whole existence as a community. They took them and moved them to the temple. So this was everything, you know, ever since the community's been around. So they seized all of these records, and these form the basis of the evidence against Warren Jeffs. No victim testified. No, there was no, you know, people that were, you know, said that Warren did this to them. So they found that he had 78 wives. I think it's possible he had a few more that they didn't find evidence of, but they found evidence of 78 wives that Warren had. But the two they zeroed in on for the charges were a 12-year-old girl and a 15-year-old girl. The 15-year-old, they had lock, stock, and barrel because they had a DNA test. One of the kids that was there at the ranch was her daughter, who's with Warren. So they had DNA tests. It was kind of obvious this is a sexual assault of a child case. With the 12-year-old, they had different evidence. They had pictures of him with her, him kissing her, and they're disturbing pictures.
Yeah, it's not like a fatherly peck on the cheek.
Right.
It's like a full-on mouth kiss with a 12-year-old,
exactly,
am I right?
Exactly. Yeah. And she's a young-looking 12. Like, I want to say she had actually only recently turned 12. She was more like 11 and 14 months, you know. So she's a very young girl. She's a really cute girl, too. And, you know, kind of contrasted with this, you know, 50-something-year-old man at the time. This very tall, you know, so there's a real visual contrast. So they're not disturbing in the sense of being pornographic, but you know, they're very obviously, there's a lover kind of situation here. So they had these pictures, and then they also had an audio recording of Warren sexually assaulting this girl in sort of a ritualistic kind of way. The audio recording has an interesting story in and of itself. It's actually been around for a while, but without all this sort of, because the other important piece of evidence they had was the priesthood records, where he talks about going to her father and saying, "I've been shown that she's supposed to be my wife," and talking about marrying her, you know. Yeah. So they had these three pieces of evidence that, even though they didn't have a DNA test here, they didn't have anybody testifying that they were raped. But these three things came together to form a very good case.
Let's talk about, I mean, you guys posted clips of those audio recordings on your website, right? And
we posted the sexual assault itself.
No, but it was kind of the lead up to Warren Jeffs was talking to multiple wives and talking about how it was their duty not only to, you know, be intimate with him, but to all be intimate with him at the same time. And,
right.
And like you said, he was talking it about in very religious ways. He was talking about kind of the, what was it, like the covenant of Sarah or the
law of Sarah.
Anyway, so but essentially, when you talk about audio recordings, you guys are, you know, the courts had Jeffs with audio recordings of him having sex with an underage girl. Is that right?
Well, and what we heard in court, which we didn't hear everything they had. We, in addition to that actual tape of the assault, which is more of, it's kind of grunting and stuff like that. It's not as really, really obvious what's going on. But there were several other recordings that were trainings, as Jeff's called them. He does a lot of trainings for people, and a lot of them are relatively benign, right? But these are for his wives. And what they essentially seem to be doing is breaking down everything these girls have been taught their whole lives, which is that he taught them, really. Yeah. It's, you know, to be modest, to, you know, cover your body, that the male is a snake, you know, to keep away from anybody who's of the opposite gender, you know, these very extremely conservative culture, you know, that is the FLDS culture. What he, taken as a whole, what these trainings seem to be doing is the women that become his wives, women and girls, really, who became his wives, he systematically broke all that down, saying, you need to be as comfortable, when you're around me, you need to be as comfortable clothed, unclothed as you are clothed, which, you know, you get naked anytime I tell you to, be ready to go whenever I want to go, basically.
And quote, heavenly sessions and all consuming fire, right?
Right. He uses a lot of sort of metaphors, and that was part of what the prosecutors were doing. We were like, look at these metaphors. This is how this all kind of connects to each other. And the audio trainings really connected together a lot of what the priesthood records say, because he'd say, you know, feel the heavenly fire and, you know, the heavenly comfort wife. That was a big one. And what does that mean? The heavenly sessions, which are really confusing because he does use heavenly session to refer to sleep as well.
Okay.
But one of the rangers told me that it was sort of a code they had to unlock, you know, and he realized when they said that the 15-year-old's child was conceived during a heavenly session, that's when he realized, no, heavenly session does not only refer to sleep, it refers to sex.
Yeah.
And, that's what they were doing for the jury too. Once it got to that level, so the court level was sort of, you know, decoding more Jeff's, because sure. He really did couch all of this in a very religious, you know, way of speaking, and there's really that sort of, that's always in the background as he's doing this with the trainings, is sort of a very subtle spiritual threat, you know, like basically saying if. It's okay if you don't want to do these things, but just realize you won't be near me for very long, you know, which is essentially being near God, you know.
Sure.
So there's always this sort of, you know, threat in the back. That's a lot of sort of sweet words, but in the background there's always this threat of, well, you better get with the program here or
you're not going to be exalted and saved.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's kind of holding this spiritual sword above their heads as he's telling them, you better be ready for all my very copious, my many, many sexual demands. Whenever I want it, you better be ready for it. And if you're not, God's not going to be happy.
So, and what was the defense's response to this? You have DNA evidence that he did, you know, father a child with a 15-year-old girl. You have audio evidence that he had sex with a 12-year-old girl. How does the defense respond to those charges?
Well, that would have been an interesting question, but there was no defense.
Okay.
Warren Jeff's people built him what the judge called in Texas one of the best legal teams ever assembled in the state of like 7 very good attorneys. He fired them, all of them.
Okay.
He'd had some drama with his primary attorney before the trial and fired him shortly, kept him on for like 6 months or so, but fired him shortly before the trial. But then when the trial started, he still had a whole team at the table with him. And then 3 or 4 days in, he stood up and said, I've fired all my attorneys. I'm going to represent myself. And his representation of himself was a lot of very long-winded, very rambling speeches about religious freedom. And there was one, probably the best, you know, kind of thing he did the whole time was he got up and gave this speech that was kind of basically a sermon, you know, defending polygamy and defending his group and his people and decrying the raid and this way that he speaks that's very sort of 18th century. You can definitely see the echoes of where he's trying to sort of copy Joseph Smith and talk, you know, talk the way he wrote. So he'll say in a way and the manner of, and just, it's a very, you know, sort of bizarre stilted way of speaking. So he got up and gave this sermon of, hey, we take good care of our kids. Polygamy is passed down from God. He never said anything about underage marriage though.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be clear, that's, you know, polygamy was not on trial. It was,
right.
It was, you know, having sex with underage girls and, right. and things like that. Yeah.
Right. Which he is also charged with bigamy, but this trial was not about bigamy. It was about okay. sexual assault. He never took on those charges directly. But so he, a lot of very just rambling speeches, just get up and he had revelations from God, about, you know, destruction of the prosecution and all this stuff. But so there was no defense. It would have been interesting to see what a defense attorney may have done with this. Cause especially in the case of the 12-year-old, it was a little circumstantial, you know, a very sure. strong circumstantial case, but circumstantial nonetheless. But there was no defense.
Okay. And so he was convicted. He's, serving life in prison in Texas. And then some developments have happened after that, right? He still has contact with the outside. What's been going on since he's been in prison?
So he's still very much in control. Before he went to trial, so after he was sentenced to prison, he kind of stepped back from leadership of the church. This is when he was sentenced to prison in Utah, I mean to say. So following his trial in 07, he really kind of took a step back. He had sort of a mental and physical breakdown before his Utah trial. So extremely weakened, tried to kill himself. He was in a very bad place, and he kind of, yeah, it went through the whole trial. During the whole Utah trial, he's very gaunt and look, you know, tried to say he wasn't the prophet. But he got better, is what it comes down to. He got better in prison, and especially I think when they overturned his conviction, I think that was a major, like, you know, sort of morale booster for him.
Sure.
So he got better, and when he got to Texas, he had a phone. When he was in jail waiting trial in Texas, you know, innocent until proven guilty, he's got a phone in the jail. And in Texas, it's a private industry that, of inmates calling people. And it's a very, very profitable private industry. So he was able to, he had his own phone. And the way that the cell that he was in was not a full jail. So he had a phone all to himself, and he was able to talk on it. I think they had the phones from like 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., something like that. For all the hours of the day, he was literally on the phone the whole time. And what he was doing was taking back control. He named himself president of the FLDS Church Corporation again. He started kicking men out. He kicked out around the beginning of last year. He kicked out all of his top leaders, Wendell Nielsen, Merrill Jessup, Willie Jessup, who had been a spokesman for the church and just kind of recently ascended to that position. All of these kind of top people, kicked them all out. Along with many, many others, just dozens of, at least 30 at that time, and then continuously over the course of the year, it's well over 100 now that he's kicked out. And so this is all before his trial, and then he goes to trial, goes to prison, and after he's gone to prison, he started receiving revelations from God, so to speak, and having his followers type them up, make photocopies and mail them out to thousands of people across the country. And I've got sort of saved Twitter searches just to see people tweeting about them. I mean, they range from, it's like librarians and government officials for the most part. And we're talking like a high school librarian in Massachusetts.
That's
and
tweeting like that, about the
tweeting
revelation.
About how she got a packet of revelations in the mail saying, what is this I got in the mail?
Well, you know, so he's sending them to random people.
People. Yeah. Okay. Like wow. It literally thousands. I mean, they make these copies and make up these mail packets by the truckload. Wow. And it might be 20 pages or more of revelations. And they're just sent out to thousands of people. And I think that the way he phrased it is something like all the libraries of the world. So, and I don't know how he puts together these lists of people, but I mean, that's just one way I follow who might be getting these things is when they tweet about them, you know?
Yeah.
High school librarians in Massachusetts, a Baptist preacher in North Carolina. I mean, who knows how he's coming up with these lists?
That's wild. I knew about the newspaper, you know, they'd take ads out in newspapers and publish revelation and stuff, but I had no idea this kind of random, or, you know, sending out tons of mail to random people. So.
Right, and it's, you know, government officials in Texas. It's kind of odd, actually. In all his revelations, there's not really much bad that's supposed to happen to Texas. But, you know, these are things like, I'll bring a great cleansing, blah, blah, blah. So so it's crazy that, each of these things is like $6, too. You know, it's not cheap for these mailings. And these mailings are coming weekly. I mean, uh-huh. The Attorney General's office is on the list, which is not a surprise. But literally, they've gotten these weekly ever since Warren went to prison. Wow. So he's been doing those ever since he went to prison back in August. And then, you know, the newspaper ads are a little more recent. He's taken out quarter page ads in the last, probably 2 or 3 months, something like that. In New York Times, Washington Post, Seattle Times, our paper, just really big newspapers that all over the country, and also in Canada and in England and in Mexico.
Whoa.
And yeah, this is a recent one I just heard about yesterday in Mexico. Israel, I mean, he's taking out quarter page, and they're the same. They're similar, much, much shorter, but similar to his mailed out revelations, you know. And some people have kind of interpreted this as like he's thinking the rest of the world will see this and recognize how horribly unfair it is that he's been imprisoned, and, you know, he'll become like a cause celebre or something like that, and everybody will rise up and want to free him from prison. So he's been very vocal from prison to sort of the outside world, and then also within his group too. He's within the group, the restrictions for behavior have gotten much stricter. You're not supposed to, the one big one that gets tossed around a lot is you're not supposed to have sex with your spouse. You were never really, I mean, within that culture, like, you're not really ever supposed to have sex except for procreation anyway, you know? So it's not, you can imagine it's not exactly sexy times kind of culture anyhow. Sure. But that restriction has been, you know, cracked down on more.
So now you're supposed to abstain, you know, from sex completely. And
Right. Huh. Yeah. And then pray for the desire for sex to be removed, you know. Wow. Also, you're having to sign over, they've created a new United Order where you have to sign over all your possessions to the bishop, everything, you know, at all income that you get, and then you get back what they feel like you need from the storehouse. And so it's becoming, and then also the excommunications have continued, that people, and, you know, and it's also gotten a little more stratified in a way, the excommunications, instead of before, traditional sort of excommunication, which Warren Duff's always done, much more so than any other FLES leader, is, you know, you're a man, you get kicked out, you leave your family behind, your wives are going to be reassigned, you no longer live in your house, you're out, gone. Yeah. But recently, around the beginning of this year, he sort of created a new designation, which is, okay, you don't have to leave, and you can still tithe to us, but you can't go to church anymore.
Yeah.
And so you're not worthy to go to church. And so it's, but you're not completely out. You if you work really hard, we might let you back in.
It's like a temporary shunning of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. And families, and then your family reacts to that too. And that's possibly even more important. You know, I've heard stories of women taking the children in the night and leaving their husbands, you know. Yeah. And that's a situation where it's not like the church leaders are directly doing that, but they've convinced, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a stigma that they have this husband that's unworthy and you know, in bad favor with God. So
Exactly. And now if you're not in the new United Order, I've heard you're not supposed to eat at the same table as your family because all food is coming from the new United Order. So there are stories of
you're at the kids' table.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there are stories of people having to take their dinner in their bedrooms because you can't sit at the same table. I mean, it's gotten really bizarre.
That is intense. All right, well, let's shift gears. And I want to be careful when we're shifting gears. I want to talk about Browns versus Utah, but I want to make, you know, clear that, you know, we've transitioned from talking about pedophilia and statutory rape to polygamy amongst consenting adults and in this news story. But, you know, Browns versus Utah, Browns are the people that were on the Sister Wives show. They've launched a lawsuit to decriminalize polygamy. I want to ask you two questions. One is how that lawsuit's going. And then also I want you to clarify what decriminalization actually means, because I guess I don't understand that very well, because, you know, really, you know, how many people are actually being prosecuted for polygamous practices? You know, what does decriminalization mean? Has it not already been decriminalized? So,
I'll start off with that one. Decriminalization is basically making it not a felony anymore. So Utah's bigamy law right now reads, it's not only a crime to legally marry a second person, because that's typically, in a way, what bigamy crimes are about, right? It's kind of a forgery type situation. Like a guy has a wife already in Texas. He steals all her money and leaves and finds a new wife in Massachusetts. You know, that's sort of maybe a more common type of bigamy. So not only is that illegal in Utah, it's also a felony to cohabitate with other people who are of your, you know, and live like a marriage, you know. So that was a law specifically targeted at polygamy. Okay. People living, because generally polygamous marriages, you know, there'll be one that's a legal marriage, but then the others are spiritual marriages, of course.
So essentially, you know, if that's followed to a letter, let's say my wife and I decide to live kind of an open swinging marriage and we have multiple partners living in the same house, right. That would be legal underneath the bigamy law. Is that correct?
That would be illegal.
Illegal under the bigamy law.
You wouldn't be if you actually people who are polyamorous is the word for it. People who are polyamorous here have also expressed that, like, and in a similar case in Canada also expressed like, hey, wait a second, we're all consenting adults. We just, you know, like there was, I think I read a story two couples who were living together and both, you know, swinging with each other, and that's of course completely different from any sort of fundamentalist Mormon polygamy, but also falls under the bigamy law and is also illegal.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Of course, none of those folks have been prosecuted. Sure. It was a law aimed at polygamy, and so what the Browns want is for that to no longer be a felony, not for their marriages to be legally recognized by the state, but rather for it not to be a crime anymore. So basically if, you know, Robin were to want to leave Cody, it would kind of be like as if they'd lived together as boyfriend and girlfriend, you know, that legally, that's how that would work. You know, she wouldn't be like legally entitled to like a portion of the income as a divorce. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So that's one difference practically between the two arrangements.
Okay.
So that's what the Browns are pushing for. And now, practically in Utah, the current Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, has come out and said, I am not going to prosecute consenting adult polygamists. I don't have the resources in my office. I want to instead focus on other crimes that can happen in polygamous communities, that also happen in monogamous communities, of course, like child abuse and
sure.
Underage marriage and things like that. And I want to focus on those things. And part of it is to create a better relationship with polygamous communities, so when those other things happen, people feel like they can go to the authorities. You know, historically, of course, as an underground practice, underground communities, when crimes happen, people don't feel like they don't trust the authorities at all. So I think that's part of the reason why they've done this. But even before Shurtleff made that sort of his more or less official policy, there have been very few prosecutions of polygamists in Utah for 50 years. And it's sort of been the practice of the state not to do that. I think the most recent was like 13 people were arrested back, you know, over 50 years ago. So in practice, consenting adult bigamists have been very seldom prosecuted. There have been a few cases of sort of straight bigamy prosecutions, but like a bare handful, three or four. More often and more spectacularly, it's sort of an enhancement charge, so to speak, like in the Tom Green case.
Yeah.
He was accused more of the sexual abuse and underage marriage, because by the time he went to court, what he did is he went on national TV and talked about how proud he was to be a polygamist. And that's what got him in the crosshairs of law enforcement and eventually put him in prison, because it was found he'd married some of his wives underage. So that's kind of how the practical sense of how bigamy prosecutions are handled in Utah is very, very seldom. You know, one of the more recent was Rodney Holm back in 2003. He was FLDS, and it was a 16-year-old girl that he had married, and she came out and testified against him. So that's practically how it is. It doesn't happen very much. It's not consenting adults, but when the Browns went on TV, it was in some ways a little bit like the Tom Green situation, where not the state, the attorney general for the state, but the local prosecutors in Utah County said, we're going to open an investigation after their show debuted. and kind of saying, we have enough, they're on TV every Sunday night, and we have enough evidence from their TV show to prosecute them for bigamy. And they said, we're going to open an investigation. But as is so often the case with politics and polygamy, they kind of ballyhooed this investigation, told a bunch of media outlets, including us and People Magazine, about it, and then they never filed any charges. They still haven't filed any charges, and this is more than a year ago, probably close to 2 years ago now. So Lehigh police completed their investigation. It was a pretty easy investigation, involved watching some TLC, and they've never filed charges. What happened was preemptively, possibly, the Brown family filed their lawsuit. It's actually right before the Warren Jeffs trial, in like June is when they filed this civil lawsuit challenging the bigamy laws unconstitutional. And they're sort of basing this on the same concept as Lawrence v. Texas, which legalized, which decriminalized sodomy, basically. So the same legal principle at the heart of the gay rights movement is what Jonathan Turley, Cody Brown's attorney, is basing his case on, the right to privacy. Basically, government stops at the bedroom door.
Sure.
And that's not really something that's been tried before legally. You know, it's been kind of discussed within polygamous communities, but it hasn't really been tried before. There's been some lawsuits that have been filed, but they've been more based on, they've been connected with underage marriage or there was one where they tried to get a marriage license for a second wife and then take that to court, and that failed a while back. The recent development in that case was the Utah Attorney General came out and they said, this was their argument, which is really interesting. The Browns don't have legal standing to challenge this law because they're probably not going to be prosecuted under it.
Huh. Okay.
Mark Shurtleff has said, we're not prosecuting consenting adult polygamists. And not only that, we haven't prosecuted any consenting adults or very few consenting adults for 50 years. Mark Shurtleff actually personally assured Cody Brown a couple of times, or I think it was Christine, actually, one of his wives, that they wouldn't be prosecuted if they went on TV. We're not going to prosecute these people, so they don't have legal standing to challenge the law.
Okay.
All right. But the law should stay. So it's kind of a funny argument.
Like we're not gonna put you in jail, but we're not gonna change the law to make what you're doing decriminalized.
Well, the law should stay because we're not enforcing it.
Oh, okay.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
They can't challenge this law because we're not gonna enforce it anyway. Yeah. So what actually ended up happening just recently was the judge did dismiss Shurtleff and Governor Herbert. They also had him on the lawsuit from the case. They said, he kind of said, hey, these guys have made it very clear they're not going to prosecute you, so you don't have legal standing to sue them. But because the Utah County prosecutors came out and sort of beat the drum and said in the media they were going to prosecute, that has a possible chilling effect on your free speech. So you can go ahead and sue Utah County. Okay. And it amounts to the same thing. If they win against Utah County, they win.
Yeah.
So this judge has allowed the lawsuit to go ahead. We haven't, they haven't set any hearings yet on when there might be arguments in the case. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a couple weeks ago that the judge made that ruling. Like, yeah, they can go ahead and sue.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm going to reveal my own bias here, but I think that the law should stay silent on any, you know, relationship worked out between consenting adults, you know, and I want to emphasize consenting adults. But what is, you know, while you've been covering this, what has your sense been on public opinion about polygamy, again, amongst adults? I think we're all in agreement that young girls, you know, need to be protected. But what does the public say about all this? And do you see this lawsuit winning?
I kind of think the public is pretty divided about it. This is based on my highly scientific reading of comment boards on entertainment websites. Because, you know, it's not like we've done a survey about this, which I
think
we
should
do.
But just kind of your sense with interacting with people, yeah.
Yeah, I think at some point, actually, I'd like to do a survey. I think it'd be really interesting to see what people have to say about it. But I think that people are pretty divided about it. I do think that there are a lot of strong emotions on both sides. I think a lot of just regular, you know, women who have no concept of the LDS church at all, you know, one way or the other, or polygamy or anything. I think that some women are like, I never share my man, you know, which is totally fine. And they feel a strong sort of gut reaction against that kind of arrangement, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, you know, just speaking from my own opinion, even though I think the law should stay silent, I personally find the practice abhorrent, you know, but if other people want to do it, you know, I'm not going to step in their way, I guess. So I
think it's a tough question, because I think a lot of people are kind of like, you know, adults should be able to run their intimate relationships the way they see fit. Mm-hmm. You know, they shouldn't have the law coming in and telling them who they can have sex with. That's not what the law is for, you know, which I think is also a fair point. I think one kind of, you know, additional aspect with polygamy is there is a lot of history, fundamentalist Mormon polygamy, I mean to say, there's a lot of history there, and there is there's a lot of things that have happened, you know, and I think that's kind of one question too, is can you separate some of the abuses that have occurred from the practice, you know?
Sure.
And I think a lot of people would say, yeah, you have to, you know, but others might argue something different. I don't know about it succeeding. Honestly, I just really don't. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. I think that it seems to me that the Browns probably have a pretty good legal case, and they've got a very good attorney, kind of a showboat, but you know, a good attorney in Jonathan Turley. And a very accomplished constitutional law attorney out of DC. So very, very smart guy. And so I think that it's going to be really interesting to see how it kind of goes, you know, and what public opinion might be, you know, in a legal sense, public opinion doesn't matter, you know, to a court judge. But it'll be interesting to see how people kind of react to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, good. Lindsay, I'll give you kind of the last word. Is there anything you want to say before we kind of wrap things up, or any thoughts that you want to make sure are delivered before we end things?
I think one thing that doesn't necessarily get recognized as quickly is I think a lot of the sort of fascination with polygamy is the sexual aspect of it, you know, which in any relationship, sex is part of it. But when you meet these folks and talk to them, it's really, these are deeply religious people. This
Sure.
is, they really believe this in a deeply held religious sense. And they have their reasons why they feel like it makes them better people. But I think that's one thing to kind of understand as you're reading about it and talking about the practice. I mean, there is a very strong religious conviction there, and of course a deep-seated cultural thing too. I mean, these folks, a lot of their families have been, you know, polygamists going back generations and have always felt like the government is after them for it. So there are very strong both cultural and religious ties to this practice. And I think that's one kind of prism to look at it through, sort of aside from that kind of sexual period
yeah.
interest that the outside world has with it a lot, which is of course amplified by a guy like Warren Jeffs. So I guess that's one thing to kind of let people know as they read about this stuff and they hear about it, is how really, really strongly people do feel about it, that practice it.
Yeah, that's a great point, and thanks for talking on it. If people are more interested in your stories, Lindsay, where can they find them?
SLTrib.com or the Polygamy blog. Google the Polygamy blog and my blog should pop up, and there's always something interesting going on over at the Polygamy blog too, which is the thing that exists. So,
good. Well, thanks again for making time and coming on for the interview. I really appreciate it. And as always, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.